You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 26. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'll be your host today. And today we are talking about archaeology outreach in local Maya communities in the Yucatan. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge the Nooch, or Ute peoples, on whose treaty lands I'm recording today, as well as the fact that this area is also part of the Dineta and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. So today I have Dr. Adolfo Ivan Batun Alpuche and Dr. Kristen Landry Montes calling in from the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. Dr. Batun received his bachelor's from the Universidad Autónoma de Yucatán and his master's and PhD from the Department of Anthropology at the University of Florida. He is currently professor and investigator at the Universidad de Oriente at Valladolid, Yucatán. He was previously the director and principal investigator of the Office of Community Social Organization in the state of Yucatán, Department of Social Development. He also previously served as the Yucatec Director of the International Maya from the Margins Archives and Experiences of History, Identity, and Migration project sponsored by the American Alliance of Museums of the U.S. Department of State. He additionally served as the Director of the State of Yucatan General Archives and the Director of the Yucatan Office of Conservation of Architectural Historical Heritage. So welcome to the show, Dr. Batun.
Hello.
All right. And we also have Dr. Kristen Landry Montes. Dr. Kristen Landry Montes received her bachelor's from the University of Northern Colorado. She received master's in both anthropology and art history, as well as a certificate of museum studies from Northern Illinois University and her PhD in art history from the University of Illinois at Chicago. She is currently project facilitator and affiliated researcher with INHERIT, Indigenous Heritage Past to Present at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Among other awards, Dr. Landry Montes was an Abraham Lincoln Fellow at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and a Foreign Language and Area Studies Fellow for her coursework in Yucatec Maya. Welcome to the show, Dr. Landry Montes.
Thank you, Jessica.
All right. Well, thank you again, both of you, for coming on the show today, all the way from Mexico. And before we get started, I would just be really interested in hearing how both of you got into anthropology and this type of work specifically. So what got you interested in this field?
My personal experience as a native Maya is, how a few was known about the history or the archaeology of the Maya, of my people. So I decided to get into studies and actually use archaeology as a tool to learn more about my own past.
So I'll go ahead and share a little bit of how I got into the field of both anthropology and then a little bit later art history, although I think those two fields are very related. So when I was little, my grandparents are actually migrant field workers, and I would go into the fields with my grandpa because I thought it was great fun because he would cut open these watermelons and he would just let me put my hands in these watermelons and eat all of the flesh from the inside. And I thought it was great. So he would always tell me these stories about Mexico when I was really little. And so I grew up with a great kind of love for the history in Mexico, but I never really felt entirely attached to my background. So as I was growing up, I think like most young kids like to do, I wanted to be a paleontologist. I wanted to dig up dinosaurs. And I was always out in the dirt looking for dinosaurs. But I always had this love for history that I think developed early on, and especially Latin American history and indigenous history. So when I went to college, I began taking classes in anthropology, and I got my first master's in anthropology and went and worked on archaeological excavations. But as it turns out, I don't like snakes too much, nor spiders. So I found this whole other field where I could focus specifically on things like architecture and art, and it was a better fit for me. So I got a second degree in art history and ended up getting my PhD in art history as well. But throughout that time, I taught a lot. And so I've always been very interested in education and particularly working with communities I was researching in.
So how, for the two of you, how does that background that both of you have apply to the current projects that you're doing? So first of all, could you tell us a little bit about the work that you two are doing together?
Sure. Well, this project is a collaboration between, several parties. So a university, the University of North Carolina, and specifically the NGO Inherit, Indigenous Lives Past to Present, that's run through the University of North Carolina. And we're in collaboration with UNO, La Universidad de Oriente here in Valladolid, Yucatan. And together, we are also collaborating with our students and faculty and invited researchers to work with middle school, or what's called secundaria schools here in Yucatan, but roughly the middle school level back in the States. And so we're collaborating with teachers and with one another to develop curriculum that focuses on cultural heritage, particularly as it relates to archaeology, history, and the sciences of cenotes. So it's very community based in that we're working with teachers who work in the area, but we're also working in 9 different communities that are primarily Maya, as far as cultural identification is concerned.
Well, I think that my own experience in previous work, I mean, doing archaeology in the Yucatan and working with communities, one of the things I discovered is that most of the people living in the modern communities in the Yucatan, they are unaware if the ruins or the vestiges of Maya civilization actually belong to their past. They don't feel this attachment as saying we are Mayas, and the previous Mayas do all the archaeological pyramids now you see and the forest and you discover. So what happened is that we have 2 challenges to protect either the environmental issues or the archaeological vestiges. And the thing is, make the people aware that this actually belongs to them. It's something we use the name patrimonialization. They have to be aware of their own heritage. And in doing that, we may use archaeology to do that. So we focused this time in cenotes, in how to protect the Maya aquifer. But then we need to make the people actually be aware of the cenotes belongs to them. And then is when we use archaeology. We use all the cultural background to actually show the people that these cenotes belong to them. Hmm. Being they aware of that, they're going to protect this is what they think. That's the premise of the project. Hmm?
So I'm sorry, I'm just really surprised. I didn't realize that they wouldn't have recognized that the archaeology was connected to them. So that really threw me off guard.
Yeah, I mean, if you ask people sometimes, they say, who built the ruins? And they say, somebody else in the past who lived here. But the thing is, nobody say our ancestors.
That's interesting.
They are in some point unaware of that. And that's a thing. And actually, it's a thing. I mean, it's not just a way of thinking. It's because the Mexican public education have been systematically erasing the past of the Maya.
Right.
Because we are in a nationalistic country where they teach you are Mexican, but they aren't aware of acknowledged identities.
Right.
We don't have identities in Mexico as you have in the States.
Mm-hmm.
In the States, you have to recognize in paperwork your official identity. you decide what you are, if you are a Native American, if you are a Latino, if you are an African descendant, or, you know, a Caucasian. It's something you desire. Mm-hmm. In Mexico, we don't have that option. We all are Mexicans by law.
Right. Yeah, I was actually going to ask you that because that was something I was thinking about before we started recording, that in Mexico there was, and this is just from what I've learned, so obviously correct me if I'm wrong, but there's this emphasis on basically the fact that as opposed to like in the US where there was more separation, I guess, between the indigenous people and the colonizers, in Mexico it was a lot more, there was a lot more intermarriage, there was a lot more kind of just this mix, and that with the Mexican Revolution, that this was something that was really taken on, like, and celebrated, that this, I guess, diversity made the Mexican people really strong.
I think that's apparent. It's what people, I mean, in general, if you see this from the States, you're gonna see that. But you have to go to the deep Mexico, to the profound Mexico, and then you're gonna see there, yeah, there's a discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right.
Of course.
That's what I was gonna ask you.
Of course, there are.
Right.
Exist. Mm-hmm. It is still, but it's denied.
Right. 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 I was gonna ask you, you know, does that match with the reality of, you know, on the ground? Like, obviously, in the U.S., it's can be pretty blatant with the discrimination. But I was curious, since there is this different focus, whether that was true in Mexico too.
So, and what happened also is that by law, mm-hmm. the Mexican federal government belongs everything.
Right, right.
So they tell you, I mean, the ruins, the archaeological sites, they are not yours. Right. The cenotes, they are not yours. The waters, it is not yours. It belongs to the feds, is what they said. So basically, they teach you that, they tell you that, they basically disattach you to both your resources and your identity. Mm-hmm. And we have this free education, I mean, at the elementary and middle school, and, you know, and they decide what they want to teach us.
Right.
And then most of the programs are too much nationalistic.
Well, I mean, and so let's take a U.S. example again. So tribes in the U.S., first of all, in my experience, they're a lot more formally set up than in Mexico, based on my understanding. But also, you know, there's also this experience of education and trying to, the U.S. having boarding schools and things like that, where they tried to take away indigenous culture. You know, there was the whole kill the Indian, save the man saying about boarding schools. And the tribes, though, there's still oral history that was passed down. I mean, obviously, I don't want to undersell, I guess, how destructive that boarding school period was. But there was still kind of a resistance to the education that was being forced on them. And so there is still, you know, there's still oral history that goes against what the government was trying to teach them. Is there still any oral history from the Maya communities themselves where maybe they share amongst themselves those kinds of connections that they don't publicly acknowledge?
Well, the thing is that now, yeah, it is public acknowledge. I mean, there is a lot of public acknowledge nowadays. It is. What happened is that there is no legal acknowledge. Mm-hmm. And that's the big thing. In the States, you legally acknowledge the rights of the tribes. You legally, you know, protect the rights on the reservations. In Mexico, we know and we acknowledge we have Mayas, we have Nahuatl, we have Mixtecs, but they are not legally recognized. On my birth certificate, you're never going to see a Maya. You're going to see a Mexican, and that's for everybody.
What I've noticed, and I haven't been here very long, I although I've done my previous art history research here and anthropology research here to extent, this is the longest time I've spent on the ground in Yucatan. I arrived here in May. And what I've noticed, though, in the curriculum that I've seen so far, for example, in the middle schools we're working with, is that there is this sense of nationalism that's being taught throughout the curriculum. So students are learning about things that are important at the national level. But in these Maya communities, for example, you were talking, Jessica, about oral histories being passed down. There doesn't seem to be any traditions of the curriculum, the current curriculum, the current national curriculum supporting, for example, activities about oral histories in these communities. So one thing that we are trying to do, one kind of unit that we have for this project, is to provide young people with materials and information about how to conduct and archive oral histories in their own community so that they can actually be the interviewers for some of the elderly people in town who have a lot of information to share. That's not necessarily being archived, right? So a lot of that might be lost in the coming years unless the curriculum changes, in my opinion.
Yeah, right. Christine is right in that. I think it's very interesting in this project is that some of these local histories are not normally teaching at the schools. So the Mexican system focused on at the national level. I mean, they teach us at middle school the history of revolution, of the Mexican Revolution, the Mexican independence. And even when Yucatan don't have a real participation on those events.
Right.
But it is not on the curricula, something about the local history. And
right.
Really, I mean, sometimes in general, they may talk a little bit about Yucatan, but not at the local level. So it's amazing when you go and talk with the people around and you ask them about some of the main events happening in the area as the colonization or what we know as the Guerra de Castas in the Yucatan, what happened in the 19th century. And I mean, middle school, high school level, they don't know anything about it. So what we try to do at a level which is very important, which is the middle school, I mean, recover the things about put together some important events and different times happening and related with cenotes. And actually try to make them be aware of the importance of cenotes has in the past. Mm-hmm. How important they are for the Mayas. They even write things about the cenotes and write up about ceremonies happening in the cenotes at the codices. So teach them the real environment around the cenotes and how important they are for the community. I mean, it's not necessary somebody officially tell you your rights to the water. You have to be aware of those rights, even nobody tell you, because it's the water you drink. But as it doesn't belong to the community, it belongs to the nation. I mean, there is a large number of communities where we have a cenote at the center of the town, and that cenote is not protected. And when I say it is not protected at this, all the garbage of all the things, I mean, have coming from around is going straight to the cenote and contaminating. Mm-hmm. And it just happened on the eyes of everybody. I mean, we have a number of communities in this project. I mean, we visit where the cenote is exactly in that town, and it's dirty and it's contaminated.
Right.
And people is like not being aware that that's the same waters in the wells where they take the water to drink.
We have one community in particular where the primary school or the elementary school is built basically right behind a cenote that we're working with our middle school students. And the runoff from the elementary school is actually kind of ciphered on purpose into the cenote. It's kind of a place where it can drain. So there are these drains that are actively put in place so that the wastewater from the school is running into the cenote. And the days that we were out at the cenote, there were some young boys who had a bag full of something, and it was kind of squirming around, and I asked them what it was, and they're like, oh, these are fish that we have. They caught them in the cenote, and they were going to take them home and eat them. So, many people are still not only just drinking water out of some of these cenotes, but they're bathing in it, and they're also eating, animals that are coming from cenotes that in some cases are being polluted, with outright human and animal waste.
Okay. Well, we are actually at our first break point, if you can believe that. So when we come back, I'd like to, I'm not sure that all of our listeners even know what a cenote is. So maybe we should start there. Yeah, so we'll get into that when we get back in a few moments.
This network is listener supported. We're trying to move away from paid advertising while also creating new shows and supporting the ones we have. The APN has never and will never make a serious profit on our podcast. Every little dime we make goes back into the network and improving show quality. So become a member today at www.arcpodnet.com/members to show your support, get some extras, and be a benefactor for archaeological education. Members get stickers, a coffee mug, a t-shirt, bonus content, early access to episodes, a private Slack team to talk to other members and the hosts, and full access to training on Team Black over at arccert.black. So check out our memberships at www.arcpodnet.com/members today and support archaeological education. That's www.arcpodnet.com/members. Now back to the show.
All right, and we are back. Okay, so let's dive into what is a cenote and what does it mean to Maya communities?
Well, a cenote, I guess, for those of us living in the U.S., the easiest way I can sort of describe it very basically is that it's something similar to a natural underground well or aquifer. And cenotes are, they develop because of the karst landscape here. And there's similar features that are also in, you can find them in Florida, for example. But the important thing to acknowledge is that they're locations of fresh water, and they're in the Yucatan Peninsula, really the only major source of fresh water besides rainfall, historically speaking. And the cenotes are connected underground. So they're not individual, let's say, underground lakes by any means. They're all connected. You
want to
maybe add a little to that, Yvonne?
Yeah, just to add a little bit, and people can actually imagine how all is this. It's good to conceptualize as the Maya aquifer, because given the karst nature of the Yucatan Peninsula, we don't have surface rivers. It's everything is underground. And all the water and all those beings are connected all over. And sometimes when the ground above collapses, it opens a cenote. And you can have these kind of cenotes which are like, we may name it open cenotes. And it looks like lakes, like small lakes. Mm-hmm. Then you have this other kind of cenotes, which is very common, which is you have to go underground cape, and then you hit it. And there is these open capes with cenotes around. But the thing is that all this water is connected. So you can see it in the ground as a cape cenote or an open cenote.
And the Maya word, Yvonne, for cenote is tona, right?
Yeah, actually, the word cenote is an, Spaniard of the word sonote. Yeah, that is the Maya word for these bodies of water.
And when you're working with the schools to teach about cenotes, how do you decide what kind of a focus you're going to teach about? Are you working with the community on that, or
Yeah, we actually came into the project on a proposal that was already written. So the proposal for this project was written by Patricia McEnany, who's the principal investigator of the project, and also by Gabriel Vail, who is an anthropologist and works primarily with codices and was the previous co-director with Inherit. We largely adopted the proposal that was approved for National Geographic when we came on the project, specifically when I came on the project earlier, and it was in April. And basically what the proposal focuses on, it has a couple of different areas. So one area is oral history and cultural patrimony. Another area is also focused on cultural patrimony and archaeology. And another area is focused on science and safety of cenotes. So we have these basically three major areas that we're working within in relationship to the educational activities that we're creating.
Okay, so I guess if you could sum it up, what is the main point that you're hoping that the students will take away from these lessons and these different areas of focus?
Well, I can start saying that one of the focus, actually, we tried that the middle school children actually learn more about the cenotes. But all this knowledge that it is not teaching at the school, actually the values, the real nature of the cenotes, together with the history of the cenotes, how the Mayas use it, how many oral histories have been developed around the cenotes. When they see, the children start seeing this, the importance of the cenote, they actually start getting aware of this. They focus their minds into the cenote, which is something that is not happening. So we call their attention to the cenotes and saying, you know, this is rich. This is rich not only for environmental issues. Of course, it is important. We have to be aware of the importance of our aquifer and that we have to protect it. Yeah, but also it's rich in cultural knowledge. So it was before very important for our culture. I mean, the ancient Mayas, they know how important were the cenotes, and they preserve it, and they take care of the cenotes. They use different system of education, but they protect it because the cenote were important for the ceremonies. Even when they go deep, the water deep into the cenote, it was called Suhui water, or Suhui Ha, which means it's the most sacred, and they have to use this water for important ceremonies. And that's a different way of teaching them how important it is, how secret it is, how many put in the mind of the children different values to really know how worth is the cenote. And I think this is really important because at the end, we as science people, you know, our real goal is to protect the aquifer, which the Maya aquifer is one of the most important sources of water in the world.
Right. And so what kind of results have you seen? Like, what has the kids' reactions been?
Well, I think that coming from an educator's perspective, which is probably what I can best speak to, I think that this age group was absolutely the right age group to go with, because the students they're just old enough to really be able to grasp a wide range of pretty complex concepts and diverse concepts. So we can teach curriculum about oral histories. We began with oral histories. So basically the background of cenotes in the area and how to obtain oral histories and archive them. And then we moved on to kind of science and safety. So how are cenotes formed? How can we protect them? What kinds of animals are in them? And then we've ended kind of with archaeology and issues related to cultural patrimony and trying to create a greater sense of agency. That, well, basically that the children or the kids feel they have a greater sense of agency in protecting their own, the cenotes in their community and their own history, their own sense of Maya identity. So I think that one thing I've seen with the students is that they begin to kind of take on this activeness in their own way. So in one of the schools, they wanted to start a cenote club. So now after hours, they're meeting with one of their teachers to pick up trash around one of the cenotes or to talk, to engage with more community members about the history of the cenote. So we can see them actively engaging more and more with the communities, specifically as that relates to cenotes when we go back to the schools.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I think we actually, I mean, we and I'm planning the project, we select this age group. And I mean, we of course, we receive advice. And I mean, people say that educators in Yucatan, they say that this middle school, the first grade of middle school, which is actually the second grade in the United States, but in Mexico, that's the first grade of middle school. And that is the better age. They got everything. And not also get it, they start talking about with their families because they go to home and they talk about it. We are very aware because we need all these parents' permit, and parents were actually also very happy of their children participating. And they seem to know what everything, all the information they get from their children. And it means that we not only hit the children with this new knowledge and this new awareness of these cenotes, but we also hit the parents.
Yeah, we just keep seeing more and more as we go back to the schools, because we began each of our units, basically we went out, did oral history in each of the 9 schools, and then we would come back and do, for example, science and safety activities, and then codices activities a little bit later. So as we were going to certain schools and then coming back to them, we start to see more and more agency in the kids. And sometimes they invite their parents over or their other friends, and they all wanted to now take part in all of these activities. And even now that the project is winding down, I still hear from several of the teachers how excited the students are and they want to do all of these things. And, you know, middle school students have a lot of energy. So I really do agree. I've never taught or worked with middle school students before. I taught at university for a long time. But wow, they have a lot of energy, and it's just a lot of positive energy with this age group. I really love it.
Mm-hmm. So is there plans for a next step?
Yes, we're currently still stepping, I guess. We're putting together 2 types of manuals that we're hoping can eventually become integrated into the curriculum, because as you know, Yvonne and I were discussing earlier, there really doesn't seem to be a lot of focus on the local level at Indigenous history here in Yucatan as far as the teaching curriculum is concerned at the level of the secundarias or the middle schools. So while students, for example, here in Yucatan, I saw their science textbook and they're learning a lot about earthquakes. So there's not really any earthquakes in this region, as Yvonne, has noted to me before, but the students are given all this information that they're supposed to digest, which is fine. But I noticed that they're not learning anything about the geography or science of this specific area, the importance of cenotes.
Right.
So we are working with one another and with several of our core teachers to actually write a textbook or basically a manual for the teachers with activities, and then also a manual for the students with activities, some that we've done and some that the teachers and even some of the students have come up with for things that they want to do in the future related to some of the themes that we've discussed this year so far. And so we're in the planning stages of this, but we're actually hoping to finish up those books by February and get them printed and distributed to our 9 schools. And hopefully in the future, in the near future, we can have them integrated into the curriculum in a meaningful way.
Yeah, has there been any talk of other ways of maybe incorporating the larger community? You mentioned, you know, the parents' interest and obviously the oral history interviews with elders, but curious if there's any other attempts or interest in moving outside of the schools and doing other work with the community.
Well, I think this is an area that Yvonne could actually speak to quite a bit, because Dr. Batun and our principal investigator, Tricia McEnany, who helped to write the original grant, they actually have a community museum that they helped to support in one of the towns that we're currently working in Tekapo. And so that might be a really excellent context where some of our new curriculum that's related to things like oral history could be a stage maybe for an oral history night in the community. Mm-hmm. What do you think, Yvonne?
Since a few years ago, we start, organizing and planning projects, what we call that community archaeology, who has two important, I think, two things that are really important in community archaeology. One is in the community archaeology we do. One is actually doing research in within communities, which is something that, in the Yucatan we have a number of communities of towns who are very ancient, who actually in the past were important Maya cities during the post-classic or the classic Maya time. And they are being permanently occupied. People have been living there since those times, to colonial times, to modern times. And not many archaeological works are developed there because they are, and the community, they are in backyards. And the vestiges, the ruins are in the backyard.
Right.
And basically, you have to do a very hard work because you have to go into a community interaction. It's not just an official permit to do archaeology or to excavate a site in the jungle, but it's to work in people's backyards. And then you need the permit of the owners. Then it means that you need a lot of interaction.
Right.
And then the other thing on community archaeology is that you have to make the people participate in the project, work with you, inform them, get their interpretations of the past and put it together at the end, your scientific interpretations. Go along. As the project goes, you go along with the community. But the other important things, the benefits out coming out of this research have to stay in the community too. Mm-hmm. And so we have been working, we have been doing this work since, 2011. We started doing work in some communities in the Yucatan. We focus our main project in a little community named Tacabo, which is about 30 minutes out from, north from Valladolid. And there we actually get some funding, and we already did excavation, the preliminary excavation. Then we map all, we got all this interaction in the community. Most of the result of our research, we decided to get some funding and build a community museum. And we put together a community museum with the people from Tacabo. These things they want to develop. They have a cenote, they have other important colonial and pre-Hispanic ruins there. And we brought with them an important guide to visit Tacabo. And it started developing a kind of a small, tourist project for the local community. And they are very happy in that. So, we are planning now to go to a second stage. We continue excavation, get more information of one of the history, which is, a study, because we already got the permits, we already had this community happy with the work we're doing, and we're going out for doing more excavation in Tacabo.
Although a lot of my training is in art history rather than anthropology of this area, I really have to say, as an art historian, I really appreciate the work that Dr. Batun and Dr. Patricia McEnany, our principal investigator, are doing out in Tekapo, because so often I see, as an art historian who focuses in Indigenous American and pre-Columbian art history, I see so many objects that are taken or were taken from places in the Americas, from Indigenous communities. And this is still largely, it still happens today, where a lot of these objects end up in museums in the United States or museums in large cities in Mexico or museums, you know, across the Atlantic. And so few of these communities, several whose members may actually work on an archaeological excavation to recover these things, so few of these objects actually stay in the communities. And that's always been something that really upset me for a long time. But so I'm really happy with the work that Yvonne and Patricia are doing in Tekapo. I think it's a great model.
I'm sitting here nodding my head. Yes. Yeah, that is a really interesting note to go into break on. I mean, because obviously the natural thing that makes me think of looking at, you know, the U.S. and Mexico, the U.S. has a pretty terrible history with Indigenous people. But one thing that I do think the U.S. has done right, or at least like attempting to do right, is NAGPRA, or the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, and the effort to make sure some of those objects do go home. So definitely an interesting note to go to break on and everyone think on, until we'll be right back.
Hey, podcast fans and digital archaeologists. Have you heard about WildNote? It's a data collection app that works online or offline on your smartphone or tablet, iOS or Android. It allows you to collect field data easily, manage data efficiently, and generate data reports and site records effortlessly. We have a growing list of state site forms built in for your use and some generic forms that will work anywhere. Check out the shovel testing and photograph forms. You can get a free all-access 30-day trial today by going to wildnoteapp.com. That's wildnoteapp.com for your free 30-day trial. Now back to the show.
All right, and we are back. Okay, so during the break, we started talking a little bit more about the community museum. And one aspect that was really interesting to hear about was the Heritage Trail Project that went along with the community museum. So, Dr. Batun, could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the Heritage Trail was actually a project going together with the museum project in Tekapo, because most of the exhibits in the museums talk about the history of Tekapo. And one of the good things when you have a community museum, you have the things you may want to see, which are actually most of the history is told in the museum. But then you want to see the architecture. You have even the pre-Hispanic Maya architecture we have around Tekapo, or the colonial churches, or the colonial ruins of the churches we have around. So we actually create this trail, actually like a tour around Tekapo, where you visit all these things that we talk about in the museum, but also you see the environmental features, meaning the cenotes and the rejolladas, which are the Maya gardens of cultivation.
Yeah, and you also mentioned that there was a beekeeping. So basically that there was, and now I'm trying to remember, but in the pre-Columbian era that there was Maya beekeeping efforts in this
community? Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, which is important to say is that in the Rejolladas, we have these Maya gardens of cultivation, but we're pretty aware that they are probably, even we are still looking for the material evidence, archaeological evidence of the large production of honey. Tekapo name in Maya actually means the place where the honey was stirred. Is what it means in Maya, Tekapo. So we have all this information coming from colonial resources that the people from Tekapo start actually taxing the Spaniards with honey, and which actually talk about this, the importance of beekeeping in Tacabo. And where, as we say, we are still looking for the archaeological evidence, working on it, but people around Tacabo is still doing beekeeping. So, and they, most of the people still use the traditional ways of beekeeping, and some people is still keeping the local small bees, which are different, are stingless bee, called the Maya bee.
Does it taste any different?
Taste depends of the flowering. Uh-huh. I mean, tap cap means this is a honey come for a plant named tajonal, taj, which is a very nice yellow, like five petals flowers, which are all around, you can see during the fall. And that's cool because we decide actually decorate the museum with these paints of this flower around.
That's cool. So how did the people in this community, did they have much of a feeling about archaeology before this museum? Was there previous interactions at all with archaeologists? And also, I'm personally curious whether you think that their reaction to archaeology was maybe any different because it's you, you know, that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. What happened is that, I mean, most of the archaeology in Mexico is done officially by the federal government through an institution named the INAH, INAH. And they do. And this is the official archaeology. And the other kind of archaeology is when foreign investigators came to do archaeology around. And there's two stigmas. Actually, people just say that, I mean, foreign people just come and they investigate, go to the field, and they find things and they never show us. And they even come with this, I mean, local histories about foreign people coming and taking a big golden bell, you know, they found a big golden bell out of the cenote and they took it. And, you know, we know that they are only histories. I mean, Mayas in the past, in the pre-Hispanic time, they don't use gold. We don't have gold in the Yucatan. It wasn't important for the Mayas in the past. They preferred the jade. So, and the other thing is when the official from the federal government come and do archaeology, as they have to do it when they have these construction, road construction projects, they have to do some, for law, they have to do some rescue archaeology around, I mean, at the edge where these roads are being constructed. And when they did the road from Calakmul to Tacabo, which is a 10-kilometer road, they came and they hired local people. They found stuff, you know, like ceramic vessels and obsidians and something. People talk about it, like knives, obsidians and things. But they said they took it all. They took it all and nobody knows where they are now. So when we started speaking about doing a community museum and what we found, because we are coming from a local university not too far from Tacabo, I mean, we locals and we are investigating, we're doing archaeology, but differently, because all the things we found is going to stay at the community. And they were really happy. And they are happy, I mean, with our findings staying in Tacabo.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. that's something we hear a lot up here, too, is, you know, on the cultural anthropology side. I'm an ethnographer, a cultural anthropologist by training, is, you know, people will go out and work with tribes and they'll do all these interviews with elders and then the tribe itself never sees any of it. Like they never get any of the interviews back. They don't have any record of it, that it ever happened. So it's that exact same feeling of, hey, wait, you did all this stuff. Like we want to see it too. Yeah. So my next question, I guess, then, I mean, kind of the obvious one is, it sounds like on what people can do, not just so based on those experiences, but then also based on your other work that you've seen, what do you think archaeologists could do to be better received in communities?
Well, I think, and this is going through what the way I like to be our research, our communities be known in the rest of the world, because I think that archaeologists and people coming from outside to the communities have to be aware that the people living in the communities, they're not like, savage people living in the middle of nowhere. People is very smart, and people understand pretty well what's going around. And they read newspaper, they listen to radio, and they're very aware of the things happening around. And publicly known, there is a way of thinking nowadays, and it's still spread in the Yucatan, saying that most of the knowledge, especially investigators come to our communities, they took our knowledge, they publish, they get money out of this, and the right. communities are still poor.
Right.
And people sometimes, they are different kind of people in the communities, and there is probably a number of people who just be happy with a few pesos in their pockets. They're happy, they cooperate a little bit. But if you explain them a little better option they have, when they have this knowledge, giving them back the knowledge of their history, the cultural resources, the environmental resources, when you make them aware of this, they also, smart people, think that they can also get money out of this in legal tourist business. Or developing, we also think in a way of actually reincorporate the way of producing honey in the past, and they can do it at the present. And they also may produce more honey, but also is a tourist attraction when you see and see. Well, the point is, if you get back them the knowledge, they may use that too. Mm-hmm. And they also get benefits from what is coming out of research, and that is only published for the entertainment of other people.
So Dr. Landry Montes, what about from the education work that you've been doing, what do you think other archaeologists could learn from that side?
I think it's really valuable to work with young people in the community. That's something I've noticed I'm not myself an archaeologist, but at this point, but I've been on several projects, and I think it would be, and I have colleagues also who work, who are archaeologists who work in high schools, and they actually take their young high school kids on excavations. And I think it would be wonderful for more archaeologists to entertain the thought of not only hiring community members from local communities to help do some of the work that in many cases can be grunt work, but to actually develop maybe educational programs as part of their proposals for funding that incorporate some of the younger minds in the community so that they can also become stewards in the future, so that they're not only just people in the community are not only just earning a little bit of money when the archaeologists are in town and then they never see anything again and don't continue to reap the benefits from the work that was done there, but so that young people who are interested and really anybody who's interested in the community can continue to expand on the knowledge that they receive, perhaps via archaeological training or cultural patrimony training while they're part of these archaeological excavations that are in town. I think that would be really cool.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked first about what you wanted the Maya students to get out of the curriculum. For both of you, what would you want the rest of the world to know about being Maya, about the Yucatec region, about the communities that you're working with, about the archaeology? What, if there was just a couple nuggets that you would like the rest of the world to understand, what would it be?
I desperately want more people to understand that when I say, oh, you know, I teach Maya art or I teach Maya about Maya culture. The majority of people in the United States think that this is a culture that no longer exists, that somehow ended with the Spanish conquest, and that was it. And, you know, there are thousands of not only Yucatec Maya speakers, but there are other dialects in the area that are spoken. I don't know the exact number, but it's in the thousands, certainly. So it's a really strong, living culture with a very vibrant language. And I wish more people, I guess, in the United States and perhaps abroad knew more about the fact that, you know, this is a very strong living culture that has a lot of influence in this region and beyond.
Right. Not the whole like, ooh, the Mayas disappeared thing.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Where did they go?
I mean, that's a case I noticed. That's just the case I noticed in teaching in the U.S. with so many, whenever we get to chapters or parts of the curriculum on Indigenous American art or architecture or culture, it seems like, you know, are still dealing with this sense that if I'm talking about Indigenous Americans or Native Americans or the Maya or people who are related to the Aztec, that we're dealing with people who no longer exist or who no longer are creating, you know, really important elements of art, architecture, culture, etc.
What about you, Dr. Patun?
Yeah, Wayanone means in Maya language, we still here. And that's one of the things. I mean, we still in the Yucatan. And I mean, just in the Yucatan, there is about kind of 200,000 speakers of Maya language. And I mean, most of the people, as of course, the identity was stolen. But I mean, most of the people is aware now. I'm happy to be Maya, and we still have to do some education. We're working together. There is most of the Yucatan people is aware of that, and working to actually present how the modern Mayas are, how they are, how we are.
Right.
And there is not the only way to be Maya. There's different ways to be Maya. That's one of the things also I want the rest of the world knows. I mean, there's different ways to be Maya. There's not just a stereotype Maya.
Right.
And there are Mayas we are educated. We are Mayas who have many artistic skills. Many Mayas who are good sporters. And I think there's a lot of different ways to be Maya. But being aware.
What about along those lines, is there a sense of connection between the Maya groups in, like, you know, Mexico and Belize and Guatemala? And what is that like?
Well, I think there is a connection with not just with the people going south from the Yucatan, also with the people going north, with the people from Mexico. That's we have the same origin. But I think the a personality thing that the Maya at the Yucatan, or the Maya in general, they never consolidate as a single nation.
Right.
So that's one of the points missing, I think, on the history, because, you know, the size of the all entire area was occupied by the Maya in the past is about the size of, I mean, all Central Europe. And all Central Europe is divided in different countries. They speak different languages. They are about the same number of people. And so we acknowledge them as Spaniards, Italians, English, French, Germans. But then, I mean, we want to put them all the Maya that are on the same area as one single thing.
Right.
And it is not.
Right.
And it is not. So even in the Yucatan was when the time when the Spaniards came in the 16th century, it was divided in 19 different chiefdoms. So I would like that word actually acknowledge that diversity.
Right, right. That makes sense.
It's just the Romance language, probably the Mayan, the different Mayanist language have the same root as the Romance language has.
Right.
But we easily acknowledge the difference in between an Italian and a French.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have to do that with the Maya. We don't put together in the same basket a huge people living in a huge geographic area.
Right. Well, on that note, is there anything else that the two of you wanted to add before we close out?
I think we're both good with that. There's a lot to say, but we would be here all night.
Yes. Yeah. There's a lot more to say, but I think you guys hit on some really important points. So yeah, thank you both of you for coming on and taking the time to talk to us today.
You're welcome. Thank you very much, Jessica, for the time and the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you very much. I thank you for the opportunity to actually to talk more about these, kind of different ideas of how to we think about the Mayas and the research we're doing, how different it is from prior archaeological work done in the Yucatan.
Yeah, be interesting to continue the discussion deeper sometime. All right. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Lemakobo jila ukuchli, tushkubanta le kochenil, tushkutsukul bele moya lob, ulumil kuts, ulumil ke, mayapu kaba.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Heritage Voices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Music Store. Also, if you like the show, please share with your friends or write us a review. If you have any questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org, or you can find me on Facebook through Living Heritage Anthropology or on Twitter @LivingHeritageA. As always, thank you to Lyle Blanqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.